We, as people, are made for work. That is something that we see from the reading that Julie gave us. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, it says this: "The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it." Or the Message version of that says, "God took the man and set him down in the Garden of Eden to work the ground and to keep it in order." Now, the word there that's translated "work it" in the NIV or "work" in the Message version can be translated "serve." Okay, so what we can read there is that the Lord God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden to serve it. Then when we see those words "take care of it" or "keep in order," that can be translated "guard" or "protect." So we can see that God put man in the garden to serve it, to guard it, and protect it. It's a God-given task. Now, it's obviously true that God put man there to rule over things, but we're not expected to rule over things as a despot or a dictator. We're not there to plunder. We're not there to waste, use for our own good, regardless of what the consequences are for the thing that we're looking after. Sometimes we see instances of people who are dictators of country, and basically they rob the country. You know, they get the profit that they can out of it and put it in some sort of bank account in another country. They plunder the country for their own interests. We're not supposed to be like that. We're made in the image of God, and as such, we ought to rule as God does. And God rules as a servant king. If you look in Luke chapter 22, verses 24 to 27, this is what it says. "A dispute also arose among them," that's the disciples, "as to which of them was considered to be the greatest. Jesus said to them, 'The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. But you are not to be like that. Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and the one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at the table? But I," that's Jesus, "am among you as one who serves." It seems contrary. It seems topsy-turvy, upside down. The power is not there to subdue the subjects. The power is there to serve the subjects. And if we rule as he rules, then we serve, we guard, and we protect. And we see that even after the fall, man is still there to work. It tells us in Genesis chapter 3, verses 17 through to 19, God said to Adam, "Because you listened to your wife and ate the fruit from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return." So the difference we see is that the work that man will be doing will be harder. There's going to be thorns growing, thistles growing, and I'm no gardener, but I tell you, I can grow weeds. He also says that it will be produced in the sweat of his brow. In other words, it will be hard work. It will be something that will involve labor. It will be difficult. So whilst the fall affects many things, such as the difficulty of the task, what it doesn't change is the purpose. In Ephesians 4, verses 17 through to 18, Paul writing says this: "So I tell you this and insist on it in the Lord that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their thinking. They are darkened in their understanding and separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts." The word that's translated there, "darkened," means like the transmission or transfer that happens when night begins to close, the undergoing darkness, bringing on of night or gloom. And during the dark, we lose our color definition in our vision. So we don't get the full picture. We don't get the complete picture. We're limited. Our vision is distorted. A few years back, I was involved in a car accident. And as a result of that, I had some back pain. Basically because of the impact of me on the seatbelt and the way that I sort of twisted in the seat, it twisted my back a little. And I was given some painkillers because I wasn't sleeping at night. On the night that I took them, I had no pain whatsoever and I slept completely through the night. But you know, until lunchtime the next day, it was as if I was thinking in treacle. Everything was slowed down. I couldn't really register things so accurately. My ideas and whole thinking were distorted. And Paul writes there about our understanding being darkened. Our mental processes related to options, choices, is dulled. We're restricted. We're thinking in treacle, if you will. Our choices are curtailed. Our choices seem limited, restricted. Our faculty of thinking is hindered. And we can be given a purposelessness. It's not that we're without any purpose whatsoever. It's we're without proper purpose, true purpose, God's purpose. We see evidence of that restricted, darkened, limited understanding because we choose what's wrong. We don't have the right purpose and we don't get the right values. One of the things that we hear about with relation to the fall is the idea of total depravity of mankind. It doesn't mean to say that we're as bad as we can possibly get, but it means that every part of us is affected by the fall. And one area that's affected is how we see ourselves and how we value ourselves. At the moment, certainly in a large number of people's understanding, evolution rules okay. It's a prevailing idea. It's a secular idea, the humanistic idea, the materialistic idea. Some say, well, I'm not really interested in how things started. It's not really important. Don't really get it. It's not worth arguing about. We can't know, so it can't be that important. But the fact of the matter is, it is very important. Because you see, evolution eliminates the need for God. There's no ruler, no sovereign, and there's no one to whom we are answerable. But you can't displace God and leave nothing. So what do you have instead? You have blind chance. Each one of us is a happy or unhappy accident and nothing else. You know, if you follow the reasoning through, then we're not actually thinking as we think we're thinking, because our thoughts are simply chemical processes. Let nobody tell you that you have no value, that you are valueless, because it's been estimated that the chemicals within our bodies are somewhere in the value of £10. So there you are, you have some value, at least a tenner. In a lecture that Richard Dawkins was going to and delivering in Australia, he spoke about evolution, how all things came to be. And in the question and answer time afterwards, one of the students said to him, Professor, what point is there in getting up in the morning if everything is simply blind, random chance, and there is no purpose whatsoever? Richard Dawkins talked about achieving things which might well work for him. He's in a very privileged position. But it doesn't work for everybody. So we endure this meaningless existence and then we simply cease to be. We might have some influence, but that can soon be forgotten. You see, when we try to displace God, we have an issue. We try to say that we don't need him, but the evidence is that we do. And that kind of thinking is the evidence of our restricted, dark, and limited understanding that Paul spoke of. We have to understand that there is a way, and people need a reason to live, and we can't lose that. We need identity. if we're told we have none, then we will make one. So, work. Some people say what we do, God's idea, is very important, and they're true. But that idea, because of our restricted, dark, and limited understanding, gets twisted. And when we use work to give ourselves some significance, our job makes us feel important. We can pursue the job, the career itself, or the money that it brings. We pursue the career because we see that as being worthwhile. If we're not paid much in our career, then we can call it a vocation. We get our value from what we're paid, from our doing. And some are valued more than others, whether it's somebody who empties bins or whether it's a high-paid entertainer. What I find really amusing is that during this time of lockdown, we've had the key workers who are some of the lowest paid. That makes you think. We identify with what we do. You know, when people say, who are you? You could say, oh, I'm a teacher. I'm a nurse. I'm a packer. I'm a picker. I'm a mother. A mother who's doing something, looking after the children. And that's sometimes seen as very low value. And if you have no job, no work, then you have no value. It's not new, but redundancy hits people very hard. It hits our value. A friend of mine said that when he was made redundant, he felt worthless, useless, and his words, without value. If we are unable to work because of disability, age, or circumstances, what value do we have? You know, these things have been around for a long time, and now there's extra. It's been estimated something like 8 million people in this country have been furloughed. The workers said that you are not a key worker. You are not needed to work, and they are unable to work. So what's their value? But we are made to work. That's God's idea. But work doesn't give us our value. I'll say that again. We're made to work, but work does not give us our value. Work is God's idea. It's a good idea, but it doesn't actually determine how valuable we are. What we do at the end of the day doesn't make us better or worse. It doesn't make us an incredibly valuable person because we've sung some songs. It doesn't make us an incredibly valuable person because we've emptied some bins. How much, how little, or none doesn't determine our value. The idea of work determining our value is evidence of our restricted, darkened, limited understanding that Paul spoke about. In Iceland, they have virtually eliminated Down syndrome in their country. Is that due to amazing healthcare? Is that some medical wonder that's come upon the scene? It is, in the words of the Washington Post, down to genocide. Genocide is described as the deliberate, systematic attempt to erase a category of people. Because what's happening in Iceland is they're testing every pregnancy for Down syndrome, and virtually 100% are then aborted if they're found to be Down syndrome babies. An advocate of the policy of the Icelandic government says, we don't look upon abortion as murder. We look at it as a thing that we ended. This thing is a human being. But what's the worth? What's the value? We can call people unproductive. And we can question, what value of life do they have? Again, this is evidence of our restricted, darkened, limited understanding. Their question is not what value of life is, but whether life is valuable at all. The secular, atheistic, materialistic idea gives human rights. Human rights, as it happens, is based on biblical ideas. But they look upon people having human rights, not having value, not having worth. We make a judgment on the value, the worth of this thing. And if it has Down syndrome, then it has little value and we can eliminate this thing. But what about other diseases? What about other disabilities? You know, early in the 1900s, the USA had enforced sterilization, and they weren't the only country. And they had it for low-income, disabled people and prisoners. After all, if they're in prison, then they're criminals, and we don't want to propagate criminality in the whole population, so let's get rid of them. If we can't be productive members, we get rid of, we eliminate these things. But what about God? What's his idea on it? What value, what worth does he put upon us? And how do we determine that? How much we earn, how much we contribute, are we profitable members of society? What value do we have? And what are we willing to pay? You know, if we were to decide as a world that gold was worth one penny per ton and we all agreed on it, then that would be the value of gold. People who are storing it would be very upset that it would crash in value if we decided that. But what about people? What someone decides is the value, and who decides is obviously important. That is the value of the thing. Matthew 10, verses 29 to 31, this is what Jesus says. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny, yet not one of them will fall to the ground outside your Father's care? And even the very hairs of your head are all numbered. So don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. God is aware of and cares for the sparrows. And God cares for us down to the finest detail, because he ranks us of great value, of great significance, just as we are. No additions, not something that we can earn, not something that we can attain to, not something that we can strive for. He says we are of great value and worth already. He says we are of great value and worth now. We're not accidents. We're not some just random chemicals. We're not just some genetic hiccup. Being human, a special creation, a creation in God's image, gives us value. And no other being carries the image of God. The animals don't carry the image of God. The angels don't carry the image of God. Man is unique and uniquely valuable. Galatians 4, verses 4 through to 5 says this, but when the set time had fully come, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law, that we might receive adoption to sonship. In Titus 2, verse 14, it says, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us. We see in 1 Peter 1, verse 18 and 19, for you know that it was not with perishable things such as silver or gold that you were redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your ancestors, but with the precious blood of Christ. God paid a high price to redeem us. God gave his best for us. He gave his all. But God thought it was worth paying a high price for these things, otherwise known as human beings. But what's very important is this. You, me, we are valuable not simply because Christ died for us, but because God values us. He puts great value on each one of us. Each one of us as image bearers of himself. Christ paid a high price for us. That doesn't make you valuable. Christ paid a high price for us. God says we're valuable. We are of great worth. Each one, everyone, whether we're fat, thin, tall, short, clever, stupid, beautiful, disfigured, whether we've got two arms and legs or none, whatever. God says to you, God says to us, we are of tremendous value, as you are right here, right now. God values each one of us, and God has paid for each one of us. Graham Kendrick wrote a song called Paid on the Nail. I'm going to read you the lyrics of that song. Is a rich man worth more than a poor man? A stranger worth less than a friend? Is a baby worth more than an old man? Your beginning worth more than your end? Is a president worth more than his assassin? Does your value decrease with your crime? Like when Christ took the place of Barabbas, would you say he was wasting his time? Well, how much do you think you are worth, boy? Will anybody stand up and say? Would you say that a man is worth nothing until someone is willing to pay? So I suppose that you think that you matter. Well, how much do you matter to who? It's much easier at night when with friends and bright lights than much later alone in your room. Do you think they'll miss one in a billion when you finish this old human race? Does it really make much of a difference when your friends have forgotten your face? If you heard that your life had been valued, that the price had been paid on the nail, would you ask what was traded, how much and who paid it, who was he and what was his name? If you heard that his name was called Jesus, would you say that the price was too dear? Held to the cross, not by nails, but by love. It was you broke his heart, not the spear. Would you say you were worth what it cost him? You say no, but the price stays the same. If it don't make you cry, you laugh it off, passing by. Just remember the day when you throw it away, that he paid what he thought you were worth. God puts great value on you. You don't have to do anything to achieve that. You don't have to work at it. You don't have to strive for it. Not only that, you can't increase your value by any effort whatsoever. Just as you are, God sets a great value on you and every other human being on this planet. Through his great love and because of the value he places on each and every one, he gave himself for each and every one to draw each to himself for now and eternity. It cost him so much, but he looks at you, he looks at me, he looks at each one of us and says, you're worth it.